For the past 3 years, the Science of Reading Star Awards have honored educators who are beacons of light, guiding their classrooms, schools, districts, and most importantly, students through transformations with literacy. Now join us as we honor this year's winners at a special celebration event, which will feature celebrity keynoters and past podcast guests. Mitchell Brookins.
2 years ago, one of my students as a school administrator came to me on the playground and he said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to be like the other kids." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to learn how to read."
And Malcolm Mitchell.
When I scored a touchdown, they either probably put my name in a newspaper. People probably tell me good job all around town. But when I finished one book, no one ever said anything. So which one am I more likely to repeat?
Find out more information and register for the 2024 Science of Reading Star Awards Ceremony at amplify.com/Star Awards Celebrations. That's amplify.com/Star Awards Celebration, all one word.
This is Susan Lambert, and welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast. On this sixth season of the show, we've been exploring how different parts of the education system, from the individual classroom up to state government, can do their part to support the science of reading. Earlier this season, we brought you the story of a teacher turned state senator who has championed literacy legislation in New Mexico. More recently, we highlighted Louisiana's efforts to get more districts to adopt high-quality materials. On this episode, we're spotlighting a piece of legislation out of Utah with a big goal: getting 70% of third graders reading on grade level by July 1st, 2027. To reach that big goal, Utah has implemented a number of changes. To unpack this sweeping effort, I'm joined by Jennifer Thronson, Director of Teaching and Learning at the Utah State Board of Education. Dr. Thronson shares the opportunities and challenges that come with pushing for big changes. For listeners living in a state or country where big goals are also needed, I think it will be fascinating to take a closer look at what's now underway in Utah. Here's my conversation with Dr. Jennifer Thronson. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us on today's episode.
I'm so excited. Thanks for having me.
For sure. Well, before we get started too far into this conversation, I would love if you would just tell our listeners, first of all, your current role. What do you do now? And how did you sort of end up this way? Where was your science of reading journey? Where did that start?
Absolutely. So currently I'm the Director of Teaching and Learning at the Utah State Board of Education. And so I oversee quality instruction in all of the content areas, educator licensing, and educator preparation. So a pretty wide job.
That's
big. With about 80 staff. So it's a big team trying to do great things for Utah's educators and Utah's kids. But I started in the classroom. I was a first grade teacher for several years to start my career. And that is where my journey for the science of reading began. I entered that classroom mid-year. A teacher left to have a baby, and I took over that position in January and realized very quickly I was ill-prepared for this job to teach kids how to read. I didn't know the sounds of the letters. I had been trained more primarily on not the science of reading, like, oh, let's take picture walks and use the pictures to help us read, and not so much what the sounds of letters made. And so I would put a letter on the board, and luckily it was the middle of the year, and so some of my kids knew the sounds, and I could point to it and say, "What sound?" And they would tell me. And then I'd be like, "Oh, good. E makes the S sound. Perfect. Mental note made. I'll use that tomorrow." And luckily, I had a phonics-based program, Open Court, back in the day at the time. And so it was very helpful for a teacher who hadn't been prepared to kind of teach phonemic awareness and phonics. And some of the things we know now are critical to setting that foundation. And so that was how I decided I didn't know enough to kind of do this work, and spent the next few years just trying to develop my skills. Went out and found Dibbles back in the early 2000s, and that really started my journey down, like, figuring out what kids needed to advance their reading. And then I became an English language learner coordinator in Alaska, and that was eye-opening.
Wow.
I had gotten my ESL endorsement in my first years of teaching. And they're like, "Oh, great, you have ESL. We'll hire you to be the ELL coordinator for our district." And I was 25 at the time. And so that was its own journey of like, ooh, I'm, again, ill-prepared for this job. But luckily, the district I worked in partnered with the Consortium on Reading Excellence at the time, which is now CORE, others. And I got to meet Kevin Feldman and Dr. Kinsella and others that really helped to advance my knowledge and then was able to help our English learner staff advance there. So I just was kind of in the right places at the right time and had a lot of great learning experiences. Served as an instructional coach. I've been a district literacy specialist and then moved to the state as the English language arts coordinator and then ultimately moved into the director position after 5 years as the literacy person for the state. So that's been my journey. I have my master's and doctorate degrees are in math education, but my work has been in reading because that's just where my heart is. That's where I believe that we can help students really be successful in wherever they want to go and be life ready if they can do the basics of being able to read.
That's an amazing journey. Wow, you've done a lot of things in your career. And I know our listeners are going to say the same thing, is that my heart is happy to hear that somebody at the state level started their journey by sounds and letters. So you've, you know, you've done the work and you've been there and you've seen what it's taken to actually get kids to learn to read.
Yeah, absolutely. What a difference when you actually knew how to teach some of those things. Kids, you know, my first year, they were somewhat successful, but as I continued to grow, by the end, you know, I had 90% of kids being proficient. And so it was like, okay, there's something here.
Yeah, that, you know, sometimes it's a really good point that sometimes it takes a teacher or an educator to see the outcome. Wow, this really does work when I do it this way, to get really motivated to sort of keep learning more and more and more about that craft.
Absolutely.
So when you first started in this role then at the state level, which, well, first of all, when you were a first grade teacher halfway through the year, did you ever believe you would be doing what you're doing now?
No, I didn't even know the state office existed. As a teacher, you're just in your classroom and in your school, and you're just happy to be there with your students. So definitely was not my dream to be where I am now. I truly love it, but it was not ever in like the cards of planning forward.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. So when you first started in that state level role, what was it that you found out about teacher knowledge relative to evidence-based practices? And I think it kind of motivated you to do something, right?
Yeah, so as the literacy coordinator, it quickly became evident I was not the only one who had not experienced the science of reading and been taught how to do that. And so looking at our educator data, we had, you know, a large percentage of teachers who had been trained a decade or more ago, and obviously had not been trained in the science of reading. Even some of our programs today are still kind of developing their science of reading expertise. And so we knew we had a knowledge problem, but it was insufficient to say like the assumption of that. So we went out and surveyed our K-3 educators, coaches, and building principals to seek to understand their level of confidence in teaching the science of reading. And that data was very telling. Across the board, our educators expressed being ill-equipped to teach basic foundational literacy skills such as phonological awareness and phonics. They felt much better with comprehension and writing. But when it came to those early foundational skills, really a deep recognition, like self-recognition, this is self-reported, low percentage of confidence, like 40% or less of our teachers were feeling confident in teaching those early foundational skills. And that our student data mirrored that lack of confidence. In Utah, we only have about 1 in 2 students reading at grade level by the end of third grade. And our data is pretty static. We've been here for over a decade. If they come in ready, we keep them ready. If they came in not ready, we keep them not ready. And so we really needed to be able to advance our practice to serve students better. And that's where we were lucky enough with the ESSER funds from COVID relief to be able to address this knowledge gap for our educators. And so in coordination with our board appropriated $11 million to deepening the knowledge and skills of our educators in the science of reading for about half of our school districts. They appropriated $11 million, which was enough to cover half of our school districts and charters to provide all of their K-3 teachers with the opportunity to participate in deep professional learning so that they could impact students with greater capacity.
And I'm guessing that teachers embraced this, given the fact that you said this self-reported data showed that they didn't feel like they were prepared. And so was this an opt-in for them? Could they choose to do this?
That is, so you, as if with anything, that is not opt-in. This was required. This was mandatory. Okay. We identified our school districts and charters that had a number of student groups that were underperforming and said, obviously there's some need in these communities because we had limited dollars. We couldn't serve everyone. We prioritized where the most student need was. And those were the teachers that were required to attend. And with requirements comes resistance. No matter how great the opportunity is, you're going to have some folks that are like, I've got other things to do. This is not my priority right now. Why are you making me do this? And keep in mind, a lot of that resistance came. This was during the second year of COVID that we put teachers through over 75 hours of professional learning. That's a lot of professional learning in a year. And they were just exhausted. There was anger, frustration, outright resistance, like, I'm not going to do that, where people had to say, this is part of your employment. You will participate in this professional learning and growth opportunity. But we had other teachers that were very excited, like, great, I'd love to learn more. But just because you don't feel confident doesn't always say, let me go do things that I don't feel confident in. That creates its own kind of angst. But by the second session of their professional learning, their hearts were changing. They were loving what they were learning and wondered why they hadn't learned this before, which we all think, like, why didn't I get this in school? Why haven't I learned this up until this point? And so that anger turned to hope. Teachers finally had a stronger toolkit to meet the needs of their students. And we received numerous testimonials of how life-changing this experience had been. We went out and interviewed one of our teachers, and she was one of the most angry, resistant at the beginning. And when I interviewed her, she cried because she was so angry. And then going through the professional learning that we offered, she realized how much better she could serve her students. She saw changes in the outcomes for her kids, and those anger tears turned to, like, joy. And so that's been pretty consistent when people get to see what happens when they take what they've learned and apply it in the classroom with their students. They just see this difference. We all have, you know, those that have been teaching more than a few years are like, well, what I'm doing is working, but is it working as well as it could? And that's where our teachers have been consistently great to say, what can I do differently to see if this can impact my kids at a higher level? So we're in the second year of implementation, so it's kind of early to tell if how well it's working, but we are essentially back at pre-pandemic levels for literacy achievement in our state, and so that's super exciting, and expect to move from 46% of students being proficient or on benchmark to 70% in the next 5 years. That's our goal, and so we'll see if we can really advance through teacher knowledge, but also the implementation of that knowledge in classrooms to impact our students.
That's an exciting story of support and investment in teachers for teachers to be better prepared to then make that investment for students.
Absolutely. And it's not just our teachers. We are taking all our instructional coaches in those schools and districts, their principals, as well as school psychologists through this professional learning to ensure that the system has the knowledge and skills, that it is not just dependent on one, but that they have job-embedded coaching support from their coaches, that school psychologists can lean on this knowledge, and that principals, many of our principals come from secondary settings. The science of reading is not in their toolkit. And so they've been able to get advanced knowledge so that when they go in and watch a phonics lesson, they can give feedback that's helpful to continue to improve practice. So it's a systems approach, which has been terrific. And I really think our teachers do feel supported. They have the knowledge. They have the time is the challenge. I mean, you're asking people to do 150 plus hours of professional learning in 2 years. Finding the time for that is hard. But our teachers are taking their weekends and their evenings, and they're doing as much as they can. And sometimes their professional learning community time to do this learning. And it's been a huge lift on our educators, but they've really risen to the occasion and showed such dedication to their students.
That's amazing. So shout out to the Utah educators who are going through this journey together. So we see you and thank you for the work that you're investing in this. So Utah made that then initial investment in this professional development, but there seemed to be then some urgency at the state level to actually go beyond that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, honestly, being able to read is today's civil rights movement. Yeah. And so the concern over learning loss due to COVID became the significant driver that created a larger conditions of stakeholders to listen to a message we've been sending for several years. I've been at the state office for 8.5. The story has not changed in the percentage of students who are reading at grade level in that time. And we've gone to the Hill and gotten pieces of bills every year that I've been here. And okay, we'll get some more instructional coaching. Oh, we'll get some more professional learning. We'll get a state benchmark assessment. All of those things have happened, but they've been parts of the puzzle instead of a comprehensive look. And so now that our data indicated need that we had before COVID, but people were paying attention, it gave that extra push to answer the call of this urgency of if kids can't read, that really keeps them from accessing other content areas like science and social studies, being able to engage in story problems and mathematics. And so there was this kind of collective energy across the nation that also came here. And that helped we had a particular legislator, Senator Ann Milner. She's been our early reading champion for several years. And she was one that we often went to with these bills. And she was like, it's time to do it all. It's time to stop piecemealing and let's work together. Let's talk about what we know is working in our community. Let's bring in some experts. Let's learn from Mississippi. And let's take that and do here in Utah in our own kind of local context way.
That's interesting because when we look across the country, we see states sort of stepping into science of reading in different kinds of way, whether it's, you know, higher ed teacher training, whether it's universal screening, whether it's dyslexia legislation. But Utah decided to like, okay, we're going to go in and do it all. What does it mean by do it all?
Yes. So the bill that we passed last session in March of 2022 had 27 projects in it. It isn't just about teacher knowledge. It has to be what does the system need to do? What does higher education and preparation programs need to do? How do we support families at home? So first, we had significant instructional implications. We put into place that you needed to have evidence-based intervention or supplemental instruction programs and evidence-informed core programs. We had not had that regulation before. We don't have a big Lucy Calkins effort here. We've been kind of kicking that out for several years. Like it's not a consistent error in our place, but we definitely still have programs with the three queuing and some of those red flags. Sure. That's the reading we would call it.
Yeah.
And so that's been a huge challenge that we'll talk about. Progress monitoring, we require it now that kids have to be progress monitored if they're below or well below benchmark so that you can see if the instruction you're providing is working and you can make adjustments along the way to have more impact. We're also requiring diagnostic assessments. So benchmark tells you they have a fever, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what's wrong. And so requiring for students that are below and well below that teachers conduct a diagnostic assessment and say, what do I need to work on specifically with you to get your needs met? Then the professional learning. We were able to go to all our K-3 educators, principals, coaches, and school psychologists instead of just half the state. All of our teachers are engaged this year, which is a lot of professional learning happening, but which is awesome that in 2 or 3 years, every teacher in the K-3 setting will be professionally developed in the science of reading. In our state, we've chosen letters as our professional learning pathway, and that's been great. I went through it 3 times myself as an educator, and so I'm like, oh, you all are going to learn so much. And then we also have a requirement for our principals around change management. And it's the principals, their supervisors, an LEA leadership person, such as an assistant superintendent over instruction, as well as the literacy director for that entity. And they're having to come together to go through change management training with a focus on literacy. What are the things you have to do in the system to create the conditions for successful reading instruction? And so that's been a huge piece.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And we've got optional training on collective efficacy. As we know, when teachers work together, the power of that, then there's parts for our community, books into our low-income homes. We also are coordinating community resources to provide training and supports for community engagement, parent engagement, and just developing this kind of community schools approach in a lot of our low-income schools. And then we're hiring professional learning consultants to be supporting all of our LEAs and how to design high quality professional learning based on the science of reading. And so that's been a piece that we'll be able to support all our LEAs as they move out of getting letters. There's still going to be a need for professional learning and ongoing growth and support. And so how do we help build the capacity at the local level to provide that quality content aligned with the science of reading, but based on the principles of adult learning theory and how you successfully execute professional learning. And then we also have a science of reading panel of experts in the science of reading. We actually were able to get Dr. Angela Rutherford from Mississippi to serve on that. She helped with their initiative, so she helps on that, as well as some local faculty, and Dr. Elsa Cardenas-Hagen. She's on that panel just to help as a consultancy for the state staff to say, here's what we're working on, what things should we be thinking about. Here's the struggles we're having in implementation. What would you recommend? And then, of course, we've had to address the teacher preparation pipeline. A couple of years ago, we had put into place that they had to pass the Foundations of Reading assessment to really be able to hold our preparation programs accountable for preparing teachers adequately to have that foundational knowledge. And so to support them, we've been able to fund some positions for science of reading faculty in each of our local universities to provide them with expertise, or at least additional expertise in their communities, to be able to make those robust programs, as well as requiring our higher education faculty to continue to support educators who maybe don't pass the assessment the first time. It's not on the educator alone, but the higher education preparation institution has to continue to support them until their third attempt of that test, if it takes them that many. And there is no funding. That is just an accountability piece of preparation programs. And finally, we've placed instructional coaches in our lowest performing schools to provide additional expertise in local communities, and are developing a digital repository of evidence-based practices and resources to support teachers and families. That is a lot of what is happening right now, right? Like, deep breath.
I know. Oh my gosh, there's so much in that bill. And
so much.
I just can't imagine what the planning looked like for bringing all of that bill together. How did you accomplish that?
This was the masterful work of Senator Milner. She is great at convening cross-sector groups to come together and to work on complex problems. So she brought in higher education faculty experts. She brought in superintendents from LEA. She brought in researchers. She brought in our United Way partners. She brought in the state office and said, we need to solve this problem. We cannot continue on this pathway. We need to see a change. What is it going to take? And so we worked for several months leading up to session, drafting this bill, going out and getting feedback, looking at the data to say, where in our system do we have pockets of success? What can we learn from those pockets to spread that success across the state? And so working together, those folks spent time looking at the impressive work from Mississippi. We connected with them. Dr. Carrie Wright asked them questions to understand their journey. And we really wanted to close the gap. Our data has been static since the early 2000s. And so we knew we had to do something different. And she was masterful on the Hill, compelling her colleagues with her great fervor to persuade them that we needed to invest more in our teachers and ultimately our students to change these outcomes. So we were able to achieve $20 million more was infused into K-3 reading. We already had about $45 million going into K-3 reading. So this was a pretty substantial additional piece that really allowed us to attack this system-wide instead of parts at a time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have one more question on that too, is that, so you must be looking at this as a long game, right? So continuing to come back. I mean, I think it's one of the things that we see no matter what level of the system that you're at, that starting is easier than continuing and keeping the focus or keeping your foot on the pedal. How are you looking at that in terms of the long game?
That has been the urgency of getting this bill out and getting things going was great. We focused on, okay, we'll help you with curriculum. We'll get some tools you can use to vet the materials that you're buying. But ultimately, what we're most challenged by, and I think we'll continue to be challenged by, is it's one thing to be getting the knowledge and the skills. It's another to apply those in the classroom. So when we're asking, how's implementation going? A lot of the response is, well, our teachers are getting trained. And what I'm actually working with our curriculum directors across the state today is training's insufficient for change. We know that teachers can go to professional learning and 5% of them are going to translate that into practice without follow-up job-embedded coaching and support. And so talking about implementation science, how do we move the dial beyond the teacher knows it, but are they using what they know in the classroom? Yeah. And that's what we'll be focusing on for the next 5 years is really implementation of the knowledge and skills they have now and ensuring that they're using that in classrooms. I was just in a classroom. I just spent a day in the classrooms on Tuesday down in Juab School District with our teachers at Mona Elementary. And the first classroom I went into was their kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Drake. And she was masterfully intertwining what she'd learned in letters with her core materials. And it was a beautiful thing to watch. And I just had to say to her after, like, that was beautiful to see the learning that she's taken and applying it to teach kids. It was just phenomenal. And if we can have more Mrs. Drakes of the world, our kids will be in a very wonderful place in 5 years. We will have 70% of kids reading at grade level by the end of grade three, which is ultimately not the full goal, but we have to go somewhere. And since we've been hovering around 50 for over a decade, 70% is pretty ambitious. But if our teachers take on that challenge and not only take, you know, the learning, but apply that learning, but that requires our coaches and our district leaders supporting them and inspecting what we expect, trust yet verify. Like, we have to get in there and make sure it's happening for the sake of our kids and to support our teachers as they advance their practice. So that's where our intense energies will be going for the next several years, is really just implementation. You know now, you know better, let's do better. And how can we support you in doing so?
I love that you reference implementation science. It's just been one of those things we've been trying to highlight more and more and more, that there are stages of this, right? So training, like you said, is the very first stage, and that's really, really important. But then how do you translate? And then how do you modify? And how do you sustain? And it's exciting work that you're doing there, but it's hard work, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you had Doug Reeves on your podcast a little while back. And I think one of our parts in implementation is de-implementation. What do we help tell teachers? You can drop this off your plate. You can let this go. And that is something that I expect over the next couple of years, that we're really going to try and help our literacy directors and curriculum directors and others say, what are you taking off teachers' plates? What are you removing even from practice in schools? We still have some leveled libraries hanging around. How do you repurpose those books and materials to align with the science of reading? The science of reading does not say teach kids at grade level text. That research is strong that you need to teach kids at more rigorous text than that they're ready for, with appropriate scaffolding, and they grow at better rates. How do we help to support that within the constraints and structures within our schools? And so de-implementation for me is almost as important as implementation.
We've heard a lot of feedback on that episode too, just with that topic of de-implementation. I know. And you could just dig into that forever and think about how it relates probably both to what you're doing, what you're expecting your districts to do, what are you expecting schools to do, and then what you're expecting teachers to do. But it is a revolutionary concept for sure.
Absolutely. I was so excited for that episode. Like, we're reaching out to Doug and his team to be like, can you come train us? So, thank you.
That's awesome. When you're thinking about, so for our listeners that are listening right now, and number one, are just in awe of the comprehensive package that you were able to get through, what would you, you know, in retrospect, what are some of those barriers that you encountered that if you could go back in time, you might do something a little bit differently?
Yeah, there's two that come to mind. One, when we said, do you need evidence-based and evidence-informed curriculum? That meant no longer relying on teachers paid teachers and Pinterest. Those are the number two most, when we ask teachers, where do you go to teach reading? Those are the top two. And we cannot support using such practices when we're teaching such a critical skill. And that was a lot of pushback. Luckily, our LEA leaders have really supported that change and are helping their educators. And we're helping them to know, like, if you need another reading passage, you know, that's an opportunity. You just need more text. You need another decodable. That might be appropriate. The practice of how we use that decodable and what we do within that is the science. And so we're trying to help them understand that. But if that's your primary source, where's the vertical alignment? Where is the scope and sequence? Where is the systematic review? It doesn't happen when we use random websites to build our curriculum. So that's been a barrier. Teachers want to hold on to what they've done. And being able to set that aside and say, I need to use my core program with some modifications, use that phonics lesson plan template we have from letters and things like that, and pull those pieces together to have an effective literacy instruction routine. The second barrier honestly has been enacting our evidence-based expectations on our software program. So in Utah, we have about $12.6 million that's dedicated to providing schools with early reading software products. Mm-hmm. And in order to comply with changes in policy, the state-approved vendors were required to submit evidence of student learning impact of at least a 0.4 effect size in order for the software to be used for students who were struggling. If you were well below or below, you needed to have a product that had demonstrated impact. And so as you can imagine, this created some turmoil within our software provider community, and so much so that there's been a bill on the Hill that passed to remove the evidence-based requirement from software. So there was some misunderstanding of when we used instructional materials and curriculum in the bill that included software. Even the sponsor of the bill didn't realize that's what instructional materials was. It includes textbooks and software. She's taken the moment to say, oh, I didn't understand that's what that meant. That's not my intention. And so software will no longer have to be evidence-based. And so that's a hard point in terms of what's best for kids and thinking about, don't we want to use products that we know work for students, especially struggling students? And so we'll see how that evolves. But ultimately, you know, our core programs and our supplemental instruction that's not software-based still falls under that evidence-based, evidence-informed. So we kind of have to take the wins where we can get them, and we'll have to release that expectation for software.
And then when you're thinking sort of at the, you know, more local level, so with districts and with schools, what do you think were some of their barriers or that they're encountering outside of the obviously translating your training to practice? Were there other barriers that were common?
Yeah, I mean, the organization of getting all of your teachers signed up and in place to do all of this letters training or professional learning, we like to call it, this is not training, was a lift. You know, coordinating substitutes, stipends, time for teachers to go do the learning part that's on their own, and getting them to professional learning sessions as well. It's been a huge lift for our community. They've done a wonderful job organizing thousands and thousands of teachers to get what we know they need with that knowledge and skill development. But that's been a heavy lift on our LEAs, and they've been great. They've had to figure out ways to work with their unions to support that. They've redone their calendars to take virtual learning days so that their teachers mm-hmm. can go to professional learning while the kids have a virtual learning day. And they've had to do a lot of systematic structural changes to just set up the structure to get that professional learning in. In our state, we used to have 4 professional learning days a year, and it used to be paid for, and that kind of got turned around in about 2010. And so this has had to bring some of those old practices back. But with virtual learning, one of the benefits of COVID, we know how to do that now.
And so
they've been really innovative in finding ways to provide that professional learning time for their educators while still keeping kids engaged through those virtual learning days. So that's been, I think, just kudos to them. They've worked really hard. Our teachers are working really hard in learning that information and trying to keep up with doing the online learning part, their application expectation in the classrooms, as well as attending those sessions. So it has taken everyone. This is all hands on deck.
For sure. And the old phrase, the devil is in the details. Logistics are really complicated and really important for the success of rollout, like for things like this.
Yeah, like substitutes are hard to find. And so to have all your K-3 teachers, you know, trying to go do professional learning, that's why some of them went to virtual learning days. It was just impossible to find, we need to cover every K teacher this particular day. And that's just really hard to do with the substitute situation.
Yeah, for sure. Well, from your purview at the state level, what's next for you as it relates to improvement of literacy? You talked about a few things, but anything else that you all are thinking about or hoping to do?
Yeah, what's next? Well, as our data's shown, knowing better doesn't necessarily mean doing better. We're increasing our focus on ensuring that schools are finding ways to inspect what they expect. We need our principals and coaches getting into classrooms, supporting our teachers and applying what they've learned with their students and holding them accountable, but with the support needed to bring them to executing what they've learned into their practice. Implementation doesn't start and end with us getting our teachers trained. It really is about providing that ongoing, sustained focus that's relentless in the pursuit of every child reading on grade level by the end of third grade. And to do that, we must support teachers in taking that newly gained knowledge and using it in classrooms to impact change. And then and only then will we be able to achieve our goal of really, we want every student reading at grade level by the end of third grade. And so it has to be around supporting our teachers. That is the number one. What's next is making sure where our teachers need support, and as they implement, where they might need touch points. There is going to be professional learning, that going through 8 days of professional learning with some professional learning independent work on the side and classroom application is not going to be sufficient for everyone. Just like in the classroom, we provide everyone tier one instruction. Some students are going to need more support and more professional learning and more coaching and being able to adjust ours to be more intense for those teachers that need that increased intensity of support. And that will be kind of our big focus, is making sure teachers are getting what they need so that they can be at the top of their game to support student learning.
That makes sense. We can't wait to check in with you in a couple of years to find out how well that has gone, and then what's next, because you can't even probably think about what's next after this until you get through this thing. So
yes, absolutely.
Well, not to shout out to Doug Reeves again, but Doug Reeves would be very happy with where your focus is on making sure the depth of implementation is sustained. So thanks so much for that work that you're doing. So this season of the podcast is all about building infrastructure and support to really help our students, knowing that we have to do that at multiple different levels. You've talked so much about that, but the heart of the work is really with the students. So if I say the phrase, it's all about the students, what does that mean to you and to your work?
For me, it is all about the students, but also all about the adults supporting those students, from our teachers to our principals and coaches to parents and families. If we want our students to achieve at the highest levels of success, we have to work together. Our students are our state's greatest asset, and we need to invest in them with all the energy and knowledge we have to do our best to serve them with urgency, compassion, and high expectations. My team will tell you, I'm always saying, the reason we do what we do is to impact student learning. And that means impacting our students to give them the greatest advantage of being life ready, which includes being able to read. And so as we kind of look at this effort, this to me helps to build access to future experiences, to work, to life. And our kids deserve it. And we have to keep them at the forefront. But we can't forget that our educators also have to be supported so that they can give their best to students.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for the work that you're doing impacting that system there in Utah. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It has been wonderful. And I look forward to connecting with you and sharing our story as this thing evolves and we see tremendous gains and hopefully can help others grow in their practice.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to catching up soon.
Thanks so much for listening to my conversation with Jennifer Thronson, Director of Teaching and Learning at the Utah State Board of Education. Check out the show notes for more information on Utah and Senate Bill 127. We'd love to know what you thought of this episode and Utah's ambitious plans. If you haven't already, join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. Next time on the show, we're turning our focus to another key part of the education system, higher ed.
I was so upset because not only was I spending $1,100 every semester, I wasn't learning anything that I could use. I just knew this was not going to be effective for kids.
That's next time on Science of Reading the podcast. Thanks so much for listening.